or even officers. Right down to junior officers, NCOs, and the lowliest private, soldiers were told what the commander wanted to accomplish, but were expected to use their judgment about how best to do that given what they were seeing. The battlefield requires soldiers who can think and act independently, who can make calculated, decisive, and daring use of every situation, and who can understand that victory depends on each individual, the command manual stated. This is the opposite of the image most people have of Germany's World War II military. The Wehrmacht served a Nazi regime that preached total obedience to the dictates of the Führer, and everyone remembers the old newsreels of German soldiers marching in goose-stepping unison. They don't even look like individual men. They look like they have been assembled, like engine parts and a tank's armor plates, into a mindless, obedient, brutally efficient war machine. But what is often forgotten is that the Nazis did not create the Wehrmacht. They inherited it. And it could not have been more different from the unthinking machine we imagine, as the spectacular attack on the Belgian fortress of Eben-Emael demonstrated. In the early morning darkness of May 10, 1940, dozens of gliders flew silently toward Eben-Emael, a massive, largely underground fortress that was the centerpiece of Belgium's extensive effort to ensure it would never again be used by Germany as the front gate to France. Most of the gliders landed in fields. Soldiers scrambled out and attacked Belgian troops guarding bridges. 9 gliders landed on the roof of the fort. Soldiers rushed out and destroyed the heavy guns. Case Yellow, the invasion of Belgium and France, had begun. Eben-Emael's defenders surrendered. That's how the story is usually told. What's left out is that the Germans gave command of this critical operation to a young lieutenant, Rudolf Witzig, whose own glider had to make an emergency landing in Germany, 100 kilometers off target. Flying in radio silence to avoid alerting the Belgians, the other troops only discovered on landing that they had lost their commander and much of their force. Meanwhile, another glider that was to be part of the assault on the bridges had landed 60 kilometers from its target. At this point, the operation could easily have failed. But on top of Eben-Emael, a sergeant took charge of the remaining troops and knocked out the Belgian guns. Then another glider swooped down and landed on the fort. Out hopped Rudolf Witzig, who had secured another plane and glider and gotten to Eben-Emael only a little behind schedule. As for the other errant glider, the sergeant in charge commandeered 2 vehicles, drove into Belgium, and improvised a ground attack that netted 121 prisoners. Great success requires boldness and daring, but good judgment must take precedence, the Wehrmacht manual stated. The command of an army and its subordinate units requires leaders capable of judgment, with clear vision and foresight, and the ability to make independent and decisive decisions and carry them out unwaveringly and positively. In our terms, it takes individuals who are both super forecasters and super leaders. Not all the Wehrmacht's officers were, of course, but enough were, particularly at the operational and tactical levels, that the German military was able to conquer most of Europe and hold on to it for years, even though throughout most of the war, it was heavily outnumbered and outgunned. Despite the evil nature of the regime that it served, noted the historian James Coram, it must be admitted that the German army of World War II was, man for man, one of the most effective fighting forces ever seen. Ultimately, the Wehrmacht failed. In part, it was overwhelmed by its enemy's superior resources. But it also made blunders, often because its commander-in-chief, Adolf Hitler, took direct control of operations in violation of Helmut von Moltke's principles, nowhere with more disastrous effect than during the invasion of Normandy. The Allies feared that after their troops landed, German tanks would drive them back to the beaches and into the sea. But Hitler had directed that the reserves could only move on his personal command. Hitler slept late. For hours after the Allies landed on the beaches, the dictator's aides refused to wake him to ask if he wanted to order the tanks into battle. Ironically, a 19th-century German general was vindicated by the German defeat in Normandy at the hands of Dwight Eisenhower, an American general of German descent who had a keener understanding of Moltke's principle than Germany's supreme commander. I like Ike. In contrast to authoritarian Germany's Wehrmacht, Free and democratic America's army of the same era had little use for independent thinking. Shortly after World War I, Eisenhower, then a junior officer who had some experience with the new weapons called tanks, published an article in the U.S. Army's Infantry Journal, making the modest argument that the clumsy, awkward, and snail-like progress of the old tanks must be forgotten, and in their place, we must picture this speedy, reliable, and efficient engine of destruction. Eisenhower was dressed down. I was told my ideas were not only wrong, but dangerous, and henceforth I was to keep them to myself, he recalled. Particularly, I was not to publish anything incompatible with solid infantry doctrine. If I did, I would be hauled before a court-martial. In the Army, subordinates were to salute and obey superiors without question. Orders were long and detailed. The orders for the American forces to land in North Africa were the size of a Sears Roebuck catalog, Jörg Muth wrote, and left little room for individual initiative. There were smart and creative American officers, but they valued individual initiative despite their training, not because of it. George Patton was one. Never tell people how to do things, he wrote, succinctly capturing the spirit of Auftragstaktik. Tell them what to do, and they will surprise you with their ingenuity. Patton's lifelong friend, Dwight Eisenhower, was another. Like Moltke, Eisenhower knew that nothing was certain. His first act after giving the irrevocable order to go ahead with the D-Day invasion was to write a note taking personal responsibility, which was to be released in the event of failure. Like Moltke, who was famously quiet, almost serene, Eisenhower understood that a cool and assured appearance could do more to spread confidence and boost morale than false claims of certainty. In private, Eisenhower could be a moody, brooding chain smoker. With the troops, he always had a smile and a steady word. Eisenhower also expected his officers to engage in open debate. He respected well-founded criticisms and readily acknowledged mistakes. In 1954, when Eisenhower was president, the Army Chief of Staff, Matthew Ridgway, advised against intervening in Vietnam, saying it would take a massive effort of more than 500,000 soldiers. Eisenhower respected Ridgway's judgment, because in 1943, Ridgway had resisted Eisenhower's order to drop an airborne division on Rome, and Eisenhower later decided Ridgway had been right. After World War II, the U.S. military was slow to learn the lessons of the Wehrmacht. It was the new Israeli military that appreciated the value of individual initiative. Plans are merely a platform for change, was a popular Israeli Defense Forces slogan of the era. An Israeli officer, commenting on the performance of a division in the 1956 war with Egypt, proudly noted that almost all the plans were foiled during the fighting, but all objectives were attained in full, and faster than expected. The Israeli system wasn't explicitly patterned on any foreign model, however, if only because the Germans' Auftragstaktik could never be acknowledged. The time for Auftragstaktik finally came in the early 1980s. Tensions were mounting, and the Soviets had a huge numerical lead in men and tanks, forcing NATO to do more with less. Generals in the United States combed through the writings of historians and theorists and scrutinized Israeli experience. Some even consulted old Wehrmacht generals. In 1982, Mission Command became part of official American doctrine. Whether the Army is as decentralized as it should be is debatable, but the initiative of on-site commanders has indisputably produced some big successes in the modern era. During the 2003 invasion of Iraq, as Iraqi forces crumbled in the open desert and American forces approached Baghdad, there were fears that grinding urban warfare would follow. A raid, later dubbed Thunder Run, sent a heavily armored column racing along main roads to the newly captured airport. Iraqi forces were caught completely off guard, and the column got through with a loss of only one vehicle. 2 days later, an entire brigade conducted a Thunder Run along the same route, but with a turn into the main government district, which it seized and held, ensuring the rapid collapse of Iraqi defenses. Key to the victory was the empowerment of ground commanders, who made the critical decisions, including the gutsy call to stay in the government district, despite running low on ammunition. The insurgency that blossomed after the fall of Baghdad was not forecast by the military leadership, and for months, even years, they had little idea how to respond. Local commanders struggled to deal with it as best they could. In the northern Iraqi city of Mosul, General David Petraeus, commander of the 101st Airborne, drew on his extensive knowledge of military history to improvise strategies he hoped would secure and serve the people of the city, and thereby deny the insurgents popular support. It was all on his own initiative. Petraeus informed his superiors in Baghdad what he was up to, wrote the journalist Fred Kaplan, but he never asked permission, and certainly didn't await instructions, knowing there wouldn't be any. Petraeus's efforts paid off. The insurgency that became a firestorm elsewhere was starved of oxygen in Mosul as long as he was in command. In 2007, when the insurgency was consuming the country and seemed unbeatable to many, Petraeus was given overall command in Iraq. He brought in like-minded officers, flexible commanders able to think independently, and the counterinsurgency strategies he tested in Mosul were implemented vigorously throughout the country. Violence plummeted. It's never clear how much credit any one person deserves, but most observers agree that Petraeus deserves some, and perhaps a lot. I talked to David Petraeus about his philosophy of leadership, and it was easy to hear echoes of Moltke. He even invoked the mantras, "No plan survives contact with the enemy," and "Nothing is certain." But it's easy to spout platitudes, Petraeus noted. What matters, he said, is beyond the bumper sticker. What do you do to prepare for that? To develop flexible thinking, Petraeus pushes people out of their intellectual comfort zone. When he commanded the 82nd Airborne Division, Petraeus was unhappy with live-fire training exercises that were so choreographed nothing surprising ever happened. You basically handed the company commander almost a script, he said, and the company commander walks 100 meters and crosses a particular road, and he knows this is where he's supposed to call for this particular type of indirect fire or employ attack helicopters or what have you. In reality, commanders run into surprises and have to improvise. So why the script? Safety. This training uses real weapons and explosives. According to Petraeus, it was a huge challenge to develop exercises that were reasonably safe, but also forced officers to deal with surprises. But they figured it out because that's how you develop flexible leaders who can deal with uncertainty. Petraeus also supports sending officers to top universities for graduate education, not to acquire a body of knowledge, although that is a secondary benefit, but to encounter surprises of another kind. It teaches you that there are seriously bright people out in the world who have very different basic assumptions about a variety of different topics, and therefore arrive at conclusions on issues that are very, very different from one's own, and very different from mainstream kind of thinking, particularly in uniform, Petraeus said. Like encountering shocks on a battlefield, grappling with other ways of thinking trains officers to be mentally flexible. Petraeus speaks from experience. 13 years after graduating from West Point, he earned a PhD in international relations from Princeton University, an experience he calls invaluable. Petraeus's insistence on intellectual flexibility, the most powerful tool any soldier carries is not his weapon but his mind, he says, is still controversial in the Army. Hamlet thinks too much, wrote Ralph Peters, a retired colonel, in a 2007 magazine article that ran alongside a piece by Petraeus in support of sending officers to universities. Chewing every side of the argument to mush, he lacks the courage to swallow hard and kill an assassin at prayer. A philosophical war crime. The archetypical academic, theory poisoned and indecisive, Hamlet should have stayed at the university in Wittenberg, where his ability to prattle without resolution surely would have gained him tenure. What the military needs are doers, not thinkers, wrote Peters. Henry V, not Hamlet. King Harry could make a decision. But Petraeus sees the divide between doers and thinkers as a false dichotomy. Leaders must be both. The bold move is the right move, except when it's the wrong move, he says. A leader needs to figure out what's the right move and then execute it boldly. That's the tension between deliberation and implementation that Moltke emphasized and Petraeus balanced in Iraq. How skillfully leaders perform this balancing act determines how successfully their organizations can cultivate super teams. They can replicate the balancing act down the chain of command. And this is not something that one isolated leader can do on his own. It requires a wider willingness to hear unwelcome words from others, and the creation of a culture in which people feel comfortable speaking such words. What was done to the young Dwight Eisenhower was a serious mistake, Petraeus says. You have to preserve and promote the out-of-the-box thinkers, the iconoclasts. Auftrag's tactic in business. Armies are unusual organizations, but bosses everywhere feel the tension between control and innovation, which is why Moltke's spirit can be found in organizations that have nothing to do with bullets and bombs. We let our people know what we want them to accomplish, but, and it is a very big but, we do not tell them how to achieve those goals. That is a near-perfect summary of mission command. The speaker is William Coyne, who was Senior Vice President of Research and Development at 3M, the famously innovative manufacturing conglomerate. Have backbone, disagree and commit, is one of Jeff Bezos's 14 leadership principles drilled into every new employee at Amazon. It continues, leaders are obligated to respectfully challenge decisions when they disagree, even when doing so is uncomfortable or exhausting. Leaders have conviction and are tenacious. They do not compromise for the sake of social cohesion. Once a decision is determined, they commit wholly. The language is a little blunt for Moltke, but it wouldn't look out of place in the Wehrmacht command manual or in my conversation with David Petraeus. When Walmart found it was building stores faster than it could develop store managers, it created a leadership academy to get prospects ready for promotion sooner. The academy was designed by the British consulting firm McKinney Rogers, which is headed by Damian McKinney, a former British Royal Marine. It is modeled after military academies, with the mission command philosophy at its foundation. And McKinney is far from alone in bringing his military experience to the corporate world. Many former officers, including David Petraeus, have followed the same path. They often encounter the perception that militaries are strictly hierarchical organizations in which subordinates snap salutes to superiors and mechanically obey. That image is laughably out of date. In fact, ex-military officers advising corporations often find themselves telling executives to worry less about status and more about empowering their people and teams to choose the best ways to achieve shared goals. Ironically, Damian McKinney told the Financial Times, companies are much more focused on what I call command and control than their military counterparts. A peculiar type of humility. But there's still the vexing question of humility. No one ever called Winston Churchill or Steve Jobs humble. Same with David Petraeus. From West Point cadet onward, Petraeus believed he had the right stuff to become a top general. The same self-assurance can be seen in many of the leaders and thinkers whose judgment I've singled out in this book. Helmut von Moltke, Sherman Kent, even Archie Cochrane, who had the chutzpah to call out the most eminent authorities. John Maynard Keynes always thought he was the smartest man in the room. And George Soros was a Wall Street hedge fund manager who worked under extreme pressure, at a pace that would drive many to nervous exhaustion, with stakes that would make many executives go weak in the knees. Soros's famous bet, shorting the British pound in 1992, which earned him an estimated $1.1 billion, required him to sell sterling worth almost $10 billion. There is nothing like danger to focus the mind, Soros once said. That does not sound like someone who worries that he's not up to the job. Even Dwight Eisenhower, the plain-spoken man from Abilene, Kansas, had a substantial ego. After World War II, Eisenhower was immensely popular, and both parties all but begged him to accept their nomination for the presidency. President Truman even offered to step aside for him. Eisenhower always refused. He sincerely did not want the job. But as the race for the 1952 election shaped up, it became clear that the Republican nomination, and likely the presidency, would be won by an isolationist who promised to bring all American troops home to the Gibraltar of Freedom. Eisenhower thought this would be a catastrophe that he, and he alone, could stop. He wanted what was best for his country, one biographer wrote, and in the end he decided that he was the best and would have to serve. Clearly, he had no shortage of self-regard. So how do we square all that with the apparently critical need for a forecaster to be humble? The answer lies in something Annie Duke told me. We met Duke earlier. She believes she is one of the world's best poker players, which is no small claim. But she has a long record of accomplishments, including a World Series of Poker championship, that suggest her confidence is reasonable. But Duke also knows there is danger in confidence. When making a decision, a smart person like Duke is always tempted by a simple cognitive shortcut. I know the answer. I don't need to think long and hard about it. I am a very successful person with good judgment. The fact that I believe my judgment is correct proves it is. Make decisions like that, and you are only looking at reality from the tip of your nose. That's a dangerous way to make decisions, no matter who you are. To avoid this trap, Duke carefully distinguishes what she is confident about and what she is not. You have to have tremendous humility in the face of the game, because the game is extremely complex. You won't solve it. It's not like tic-tac-toe or checkers, she says. It's very hard to master, and if you're not learning all the time, you will fail. That being said, humility in the face of the game is extremely different than humility in the face of your opponents. Duke feels confident that she can compete with most people she sits down with at a poker table. But that doesn't mean I think I've mastered this game. The humility required for good judgment is not self-doubt, the sense that you are untalented, unintelligent, or unworthy. It is intellectual humility. It is a recognition that reality is profoundly complex, that seeing things clearly is a constant struggle, when it can be done at all, and that human judgment must therefore be riddled with mistakes. This is true for fools and geniuses alike. So it's quite possible to think highly of yourself and be intellectually humble. In fact, this combination can be wonderfully fruitful. Intellectual humility compels the careful reflection necessary for good judgment. Confidence in one's abilities inspires determined action. With firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, Abraham Lincoln declared in his second inaugural address. It's a statement of fierce conviction and determination, but it is also a humble acknowledgement, as God gives us to see the right, that our vision is limited, our judgment flawed, and even firmest belief may be wrong. Postscript. There is a dangling question. Did I have to choose the Wehrmacht? Other organizations illustrate how thinking like a super forecaster can improve leader performance. So why make the point with an army that served the evilest cause in modern history? Understanding what worked in the Wehrmacht requires engaging in the toughest of all forms of perspective taking, acknowledging that something we despise possesses impressive qualities. Forecasters who can't cope with the dissonance risk making the most serious possible forecasting error in a conflict, underestimating your opponent. There is no divinely mandated link between morality and competence. If the Puritan poet John Milton could portray Satan as both evil and resourceful in Paradise Lost, is it too much to acknowledge the same could be true of the Wehrmacht? Forecasters who see illusory correlations and assume that moral and cognitive weaknesses run together will fail when we need them most. We don't want intelligence analysts to assume jihadist groups must be inept, or that vicious regimes can't be creatively vicious. Coping with dissonance is hard. The test of a first-rate intelligence is the ability to hold two opposed ideas in mind at the same time and still retain the ability to function, F. Scott Fitzgerald observed in The Crack Up. It requires teasing apart our feelings about the Nazi regime from our factual judgments about the Wehrmacht's organizational resilience, and to see the Wehrmacht as both a horrific organization that deserved to be destroyed and an effective organization with lessons to teach us. There is no logical contradiction, just a psychological tension. If you want to become a super forecaster, you must overcome it. It's a challenge. Even super forecasters who excel at aggressive self-criticism sometimes conflate facts and values, Early in the Syrian civil war, Doug Lorch flubbed a question on whether the rebels would take the city of Aleppo. When he considered why, he realized he had let his loathing of the Assad regime lead him to the wishful conclusion that the rebels would win, despite evidence they were outgunned. Joshua Frankel floundered forecasting whether North Korea would detonate a nuclear weapon because he was influenced by optimism and hope for progress, he recalled. He didn't sense it at the time, but a couple of weeks before the closing date, a conversation with a good friend, who happens to have family members who escaped from North Korea at the time of the Korean War, made me realize this, and he flipped his forecast. So why use the Wehrmacht as an illusion, even though it makes us squirm? Precisely because it makes us squirm. Chapter 11. Are they really so super? For as long as I have been running forecasting tournaments, from Ronald Reagan and Red Army parades to today, I have been talking with Daniel Kahneman about my work. For that, I have been supremely fortunate. Kahneman is the accidental Nobelist, a cognitive psychologist who had no training in economics, but whose work shook the foundations of the field. He is also a superb conversationalist who moves fluidly between casual banter and incisive dissection of casual banter. Talking to Kahneman can be a Socratic experience, energizing as long as you don't hunker down into a defensive crouch. So in the summer of 2014, when it was clear that super forecasters were not merely super lucky, Kahneman cut to the chase. Do you see them as different kinds of people or as people who do different kinds of things? My answer was, a bit of both. They score higher than average on measures of intelligence and open-mindedness, although they are not off the charts. What makes them so good is less what they are than what they do. The hard work of research, the careful thought and self-criticism, the gathering and synthesizing of other perspectives, the granular judgments and relentless updating. But how long can they sustain it? As we saw, people can, in principle, use conscious System 2 reflection to catch mistakes arising from a rapid, unconscious System 1 operations. Super forecasters put enormous effort into doing just that. But the continuous self-scrutiny is exhausting, and the feeling of knowing is seductive. Surely, even the best of us will inevitably slip back into easier, intuitive modes of thinking. Consider a 2014 interview with General Michael Flynn, who summed up his view of the world shortly before retiring as head of the Defense Intelligence Agency, DIA, the Pentagon's equivalent of the CIA, with 17,000 employees. I come into this office every morning, and other than a short jog to clear my head, I spend 2 or 3 hours reading intelligence reports, he said. I will frankly tell you that what I see each day is the most uncertain, chaotic, and confused international environment that I've witnessed in my entire career. There were probably more dangerous times, such as when the Nazis and Japanese imperialists were trying to dominate the world, but we're in another very dangerous era. I think we're in a period of prolonged societal conflict that is pretty unprecedented. Much of what Flynn said is too vague to be judged, but his final line isn't. In the context of the interview, the reporter had mentioned conflicts in Ukraine, Korea, and the Middle East. That statement makes it clear that Flynn believes societal conflict is at a pretty unprecedented level. That is an empirical claim that can be checked by reviewing the many reports that have quantified global violence since World War II. And what they all show, broadly, is that interstate wars have been declining since the 1950s, and civil wars have been declining since the end of the Cold War in the early 1990s. This is reflected in the number of battle deaths per year, which, with a few blips, decline throughout the period. You don't have to be the head of the DIA to find those reports. Googling global conflict trends will suffice. But Flynn saw no need to do so before drawing his sweeping conclusion and sharing it. Why not? The same reason Peggy Noonan saw no need to consult the data on other former presidents' approval ratings when she judged the meaning of President Bush's rising appeal. At work in each case was Kahneman's WYSIATI. What you see is all there is. The mother of all cognitive illusions. The egocentric worldview that prevents us from seeing any world beyond the one visible from the tips of our noses. Flynn saw mountains of bad news on his desk every day, and his conclusion felt right. So, that was all there was. As a lifelong intelligence officer, Flynn knew the importance of checking assumptions, no matter how true they feel. But he didn't, because it didn't feel like an assumption. It felt true. It's the oldest trick in the psychological book, and Flynn fell for it. I am not belittling Michael Flynn, quite the opposite. The fact that a man so accomplished made so obvious an error is precisely what makes the error notable. We are all vulnerable, and there's no way to make ourselves bulletproof, as the famous Mueller-Lyer optical illusion illustrates. The top horizontal line looks longer than the line below it, but it's not. If you are unsure, take out a ruler and measure. Once you are fully satisfied that the lines are identical, look again. But now, try to see the lengths of the two lines accurately. No luck? You know the lines are the same. You want to see them that way. But you can't. Not even knowing it's an illusion can switch off the illusion. The cognitive illusions that the tip of your nose perspective sometimes generates are similarly impossible to stop. We can't switch off the tip of our nose perspective. We can only monitor the answers that bubble up into consciousness, and when we have the time and cognitive capacity, use a ruler to check. Viewed in this light, superforecasters are always just a System 2 slip-up away from a blown forecast and a nasty tumble down the rankings. Kahneman and I agree about that. But I am more optimistic that smart, dedicated people can inoculate themselves to some degree against certain cognitive illusions. That may sound like a tempest in an academic teapot, but it has real-world implications. If I am right, organizations will have more to gain from recruiting and training talented people to resist biases. Although Kahneman officially retired long ago, he still practices adversarial collaboration, his commitment as a scientist to finding common ground with those who hold different views. So just as Kahneman worked with Gary Klein to resolve their disputes about expert intuition, he worked with Barbara Mellers to explore the capacity of superforecasters to resist a bias of particularly deep relevance to superforecasting. Scope insensitivity. Kahneman first documented scope insensitivity 30 years ago when he asked a randomly selected group in Toronto, the capital city of Ontario, how much they would be willing to pay to clean up the lakes in a small region of the province. On average, people said about $10. Kahneman asked another randomly selected group how much they would be willing to pay to clean up every one of the 250,000 lakes in Ontario. They too said about $10. Later research got similar results. One study informed people that each year 2,000 migratory birds drown in oil ponds. How much would you be willing to pay to stop that? Other subjects were told 20,000 birds died each year. A third group was told it was 200,000 birds. And yet, in each case, the average amount people said they would be willing to pay was around $80. What people were responding to, Kahneman later wrote, was the prototypical image that came to them, a polluted lake or a drowning, oil-soaked duck. The prototype automatically evokes an affective response, and the intensity of that emotion is then mapped onto the dollar scale. It's a classic bait-and-switch. Instead of answering the question asked, a difficult one that requires putting a money value on things we never monetize, people answered, "How bad does this make me feel?" Whether the question is about 2,000 or 200,000 dying ducks, the answer is roughly the same: bad. Scope recedes into the background, and out of sight, out of mind. What do polluted lakes have to do with the Syrian civil war, or any of the other geopolitical problems posed in the IARPA tournament? If you are as creative as Daniel Kahneman, the answer is, a lot. Flashback to early 2012. How likely is the Assad regime to fall? Arguments against a fall include, 1. The regime has well-armed core supporters. Two, it has powerful regional allies. Arguments in favor of the fall include, one, the Syrian army is suffering massive defections. Two, the rebels have some momentum, with fighting reaching the capital. Suppose you weight the strength of these arguments. They feel roughly equal, and you settle on a probability of roughly 50%. But notice what's missing? The time frame. It obviously matters. To use an extreme illustration, the probability of the regime falling in the next 24 hours must be less, likely a lot less, than the probability that it will fall in the next 24 months. To put this in Kahneman's terms, the time frame is the scope of the forecast. So we asked one randomly selected group of super forecasters, how likely is it that the Assad regime will fall in the next 3 months? Another group was asked how likely it was in the next 6 months. We did the same experiment with regular forecasters. Kahneman predicted widespread scope insensitivity. Unconsciously, they would do a bait and switch, ducking the hard question that requires calibrating the probability to the time frame, and tackling the easier question about the relative weight of the arguments for and against the regime's downfall. The time frame would make no difference to the final answers, just as it made no difference whether 2,000, 20,000, or 200,000 migratory birds died. Mellers ran several studies and found that, exactly as Kahneman expected, the vast majority of forecasters were scope insensitive. Regular forecasters said there was a 40% chance Assad's regime would fall over 3 months and a 41% chance it would fall over 6 months. But the super forecasters did much better. They put the probability of Assad's fall at 15% over 3 months and 24% over 6 months. That's not perfect scope sensitivity, a tricky thing to define, but it was good enough to surprise Kahneman. If we bear in mind that no one was asked both the 3- and 6-month version of the question, that's quite an accomplishment. It suggests that the super forecasters not only paid attention to the time frame in the question, but also thought about other possible time frames, and thereby shook off a hard-to-shake bias. I wish I could take credit for that. Our advanced training guidelines urge forecasters to mentally tinker with the question asked, and explore how their answers to a time in question might change if the cutoff date were 6 months out instead of 12, or if the target price for oil were 10% lower, or some other relevant variation. Running such thought experiments inside your head is a good way to stress test the adequacy of your mental model of the problem and ensure you are scope sensitive. But the truth is, super forecasters were talking about problems of scope insensitivity, although they didn't use that term, before we started to study it. And their thinking helped inform our training guidelines as much as our training guidelines inform their thinking. My sense is that some super forecasters are so well practiced in System 2 corrections, such as stepping back to take the outside view, that these techniques have become habitual. In effect, they are now part of their System 1. That may sound bizarre, but it's not an unusual process. Any golfer can recall the first time she stood at a tee and was told to bend at the knees, tilt her head just so, raise one shoulder, drop the other, lift the elbow. It was awkward and required self-conscious monitoring. The second time she set up at the tee, she had to laboriously work through this mental checklist. Bend at knees, tilt head, raise shoulder. And even with great mental effort, she still forgot something and had to be corrected. The third time was the same, but slowly it got easier. A golfer who keeps at it will eventually bury those instructions in System 1 and do it all gracefully. No matter how physically or cognitively demanding a task may be, cooking, sailing, surgery, operatic singing, flying fighter jets, deliberative practice can make it second nature. Ever watch a child struggling to sound out words and grasp the meaning of a sentence? That was you once. Fortunately, reading this sentence isn't nearly so demanding for you now. So how long can super forecasters defy the laws of psychological gravity? The answer to that depends on how heavy their cognitive loads are. Turning a self-conscious System 2 correction into an unconscious System 1 operation may lighten the load considerably. So may the software tools some super forecasters have developed. Like Doug Lorch's new source selection program, designed to correct the System 1 bias in favor of the like-minded. But still, super forecasting remains hard work. Those who do it well appreciate the fragility of their success. They expect to stumble. And when they do, they will get up, try to draw the right lessons, and keep forecasting. But another friend and colleague is not as impressed by the super forecasters as I am. Indeed, he suspects this whole research program is misguided. Enter the Black Swan. Nassim Taleb is a former Wall Street trader whose thinking about uncertainty and probability has produced three enormously influential books and turned Black Swan into a common English phrase. For those unfamiliar with the concept, imagine you are a European living four centuries ago. You have seen many swans in your life to date. All were white. If you were asked to envision all the possible swans you might ever encounter, you would probably imagine lots and lots of swans that vary in size and shape. But all would be white, because your experience has taught you all swans are white. But then a ship returns from Australia. On board is a swan. A black swan. You are stunned. The black swan is therefore a brilliant metaphor for an event so outside experience, we can't even imagine it until it happens. But Taleb isn't interested only in surprise. A black swan must be impactful. Indeed, Taleb insists that black swans and black swans alone determine the course of history. History and societies do not crawl, he wrote. They make jumps. The implication for my efforts to improve foresight are devastating. IARPA has commissioned a fool's errand. What matters can't be forecast, and what can be forecast doesn't matter. Believing otherwise lulls us into a false sense of security. In this view, I have taken a scientific step backward. In my EPJ research, I got it roughly right with a punchline about experts and the dart-throwing chimp. But my good judgment project is premised on misconceptions, panders to desperation, and fosters foolish complacency. I respect Taleb. He and I have even co-written a paper on a key area where we agree. I think his critique makes deep points that future tournaments will have to struggle to address. But I see another false dichotomy rearing its head. Forecasting is feasible if you follow my formula versus forecasting is bunk. Dispelling the dichotomy requires putting the beguiling black swan metaphor under the analytic microscope. What exactly is a black swan? The stringent definition is something literally inconceivable before it happens. Taleb has implied as much on occasion. If so, many events dubbed black swans are actually gray. Consider the 9/11 terrorist attacks, the prototypic black swan in which one dazzling sunny morning in September, a bolt from the blue changed history. But 9/11 was not unimaginable. In 1994, a plot to hijack a jet and crash it into the Eiffel Tower was broken up. In 1998, the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration examined a scenario in which terrorists hijacked FedEx cargo planes and crashed them into the World Trade Center. The danger was so well known in security circles that in August 2001, a government official asked Louise Richardson, a Harvard terrorism expert, why no terrorist group had ever used an airplane as a flying bomb. My answer was far from helpful, she later wrote. I said that the tactic was very much under consideration, and I suspected that some terrorist groups would use it sooner rather than later. Other events that have been called black swans, such as the outbreak of World War I, which was preceded by more than a decade of fretting about the danger of war among the great powers, also failed the unimaginability test. If black swans must be inconceivable before they happen, a rare species of event suddenly becomes a lot rarer. But Taleb also offers a more modest definition of a black swan as a highly improbable consequential event. These are not hard to find in history. As Taleb and I explored in our joint paper, this is where the truth in his critique can be found. If forecasters make hundreds of forecasts that look out only a few months, we will soon have enough data to judge how well calibrated they are. But by definition, highly improbable events almost never happen. If we take highly improbable to mean a 1% or 0.1% or 0.0001% chance of an event, it may take decades or centuries or millennia to pile up enough data. And if these events have to be not only highly improbable but also impactful, the difficulty multiplies. So the first generation IARPA tournament tells us nothing about how good super forecasters are at spotting gray or black swans. They may be as clueless as anyone else, or astonishingly adept. We don't know, and we shouldn't fool ourselves that we do. Now, if you believe that only black swans matter in the long run, the Good Judgment Project should only interest short-term thinkers. But history is not just about black swans. Look at the inchworm advance in life expectancy. Or consider that an average of 1% annual global economic growth in the 19th century and 2% in the 20th century turned the squalor of the 18th century and all the centuries that preceded it into the unprecedented wealth of the 21st. History does sometimes jump, but it also crawls, and slow incremental change can be profoundly important. A useful analogy lies in the world of investing. Vinod Khosla is the co-founder of Sun Microsystems and a Silicon Valley venture capitalist. He is also a big fan of Nassim Taleb. Investing in the notoriously volatile world of technology, Khosla has watched countless forecasts fail, and he knows he can't specify the next big thing with exactitude. So he spreads his investments around, expecting most to fail, but hoping that he will, occasionally, find one or two of the rare startups that beat the odds and yield a Google-sized fortune. Most people lack the stomach for this, because they look at it the wrong way, he told me in 2013. It's funny that a 90% chance of failing people don't like, but a 10% chance of changing the world people love. This is black swan investing, and it's similar to how Taleb himself traded, very successfully, before becoming an author. But it's not the only way to invest. A very different way is to beat competitors by forecasting more accurately. For example, correctly deciding that there is a 68% chance of something happening when others foresee only a 60% chance. This is the approach of the best poker players. It pays off more often, but the returns are more modest, and fortunes are amassed slowly. It is neither superior nor inferior to black swan investing. It is different. There is another big reason not to dismiss forecasting tournaments. What elevates a mere surprise to black swan status are the event's consequences. But consequences take time to develop. On July 14, 1789, a mob took control of a prison in Paris known as the Bastille. But we mean something much bigger than what happened that day when we refer today to the storming of the Bastille. We mean the actual event plus the events it triggered that spiraled into the French Revolution. That's why, centuries later, July 14th is the national holiday of France. The more you want to explain about a black swan event like the storming of the Bastille, wrote the sociologist Duncan Watts, the broader you have to draw the boundaries around what you consider to be the event itself. In this light, black swans are not as wildly unpredictable as supposed. 3 days after terrorists flew jets into the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, the U.S. government demanded that the Taliban rulers of Afghanistan hand over Osama bin Laden and other al-Qaeda terrorists. The Taliban said they would comply if the U.S. government produced satisfactory evidence of al-Qaeda's guilt. The United States prepared for an invasion. Still, the Taliban refused to hand over bin Laden. Finally, almost a month after 9/11, the United States attacked. Today, when we refer to the black swan of 9/11, we mean the attack plus the consequences, which include the invasion of Afghanistan. But that sequence of events could arguably have gone differently. Bin Laden and al-Qaeda were Arabic-speaking foreigners in Afghanistan, and the Taliban could have decided that sheltering them just wasn't worth incurring the wrath of the world's sole superpower, right when they were on the cusp of finally destroying the Northern Alliance, their hated rivals. Or, sensing imminent extradition, Bin Laden and his followers could have fled to Pakistan, Somalia, or Yemen. You could imagine a scenario in which there was no invasion of Afghanistan, or no 10-year hunt for Osama bin Laden. And we would then see 9/11 differently. A tragedy, certainly. But not the opening shot and a series of wars that dominated a decade. We may have no evidence that super forecasters can foresee events like those of September 11, 2001, but we do have a warehouse of evidence that they can forecast questions like, will the United States threaten military action if the Taliban don't hand over Osama bin Laden? Will the Taliban comply? Will bin Laden flee Afghanistan prior to the invasion? To the extent that such forecasts can anticipate the consequences of events like 9/11, and these consequences make a black swan what it is, we can forecast black swans. All that said, I see Kahneman's and Taleb's critiques as the strongest challenges to the notion of super-forecasting. We are far enough apart empirically and close enough philosophically to make communication, even collaboration, possible. To see how close we are, consider a bureaucratic memo that would never have made it into history's footnotes, but for the accident of its timing. On April 11, 2001, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld sent a memo to President George W. Bush and Vice President Dick Cheney. I ran across this piece on the difficulty of predicting the future, Rumsfeld wrote. I thought you might find it interesting. The piece looks at the strategic situation at the start of each decade, between 1900 and 2000, and shows that, in every case, the reality was a stunning change from 10 years earlier. All of which is to say that I'm not sure what 2010 will look like, concluded its author, Linton Wells. But I'm sure that it will be very little like what we expect, so we should plan accordingly. Thoughts for the 2001 Quadrennial Defense Review. If you had been a security policy maker in the world's greatest power in 1900, you would have been a Brit, looking warily at your age-old enemy, France. By 1910, you would be allied with France, and your enemy would be Germany. By 1920, World War I would have been fought and won, and you'd be engaged in a naval arms race with your erstwhile allies, the U.S. and Japan. By 1930, naval arms limitation treaties were in effect, the Great Depression was underway, and the defense planning standard said, no war for 10 years. 9 years later, World War II had begun. By 1950, Britain no longer was the world's greatest power, the atomic age had dawned, and a police action was underway in Korea. 10 years later, the political focus was on the missile gap, the strategic paradigm was shifting from massive retaliation to flexible response, and few people had heard of Vietnam. By 1970, the peak of our involvement in Vietnam had come and gone, we were beginning détente with the Soviets, and we were anointing the Shah as our protégé in the Gulf region. By 1980, the Soviets were in Afghanistan, Iran was in the throes of revolution, there was talk of our hollow forces, and a window of vulnerability, and the U.S. was the greatest creditor nation the world had ever seen. By 1990, the Soviet Union was within a year of dissolution, American forces in the desert were on the verge of showing they were anything but hollow, the U.S. had become the greatest debtor nation the world had ever known, and almost no one had heard of the Internet. 10 years later, Warsaw was the capital of a NATO nation, asymmetric threats transcended geography, and the parallel revolutions of information, biotechnology, robotics, nanotechnology, and high-density energy sources foreshadowed changes almost beyond forecasting. All of which is to say that I'm not sure what 2010 will look like, but I'm sure that it will be very little like we expect, so we should plan accordingly. Lynn Wells. Precisely 5 months after Rumsfeld wrote his memo, a terrorist cell crashed jets into the Twin Towers and the Pentagon. The decade that followed was yet another that bore little resemblance to what the chattering classes expected at its launch. Taleb, Kahneman, and I agree there is no evidence that geopolitical or economic forecasts can predict anything 10 years out, beyond the excruciatingly obvious. There will be conflicts, and the odd lucky hits that are inevitable whenever lots of forecasters make lots of forecasts. These limits on predictability are the predictable results of the butterfly dynamics of nonlinear systems, In my EPJ research, the accuracy of expert predictions declined toward chance 5 years out. And yet, this sort of forecasting is common, even within institutions that should know better. Every 4 years, Congress requires the Department of Defense to produce a 20-year forecast of the national security environment. Enormous effort goes into this quadrennial defense review, noted Richard Danzig, a former Secretary of the Navy. It was this ritualistic exercise that prompted Lynn Wells to commit a modest act of intellectual rebellion and write his article. Wells hinted at a better way in his closing comment. If you have to plan for a future beyond the forecasting horizon, plan for surprise. That means, as Danzig advises, planning for adaptability and resilience. Imagine a scenario in which reality gives you a smack in the ear and consider how you would respond. Then assume reality will give you a kick in the shin and think about dealing with that. Plans are useless, Eisenhower said about preparing for battle, but planning is indispensable. Taleb has taken this argument further and called for critical systems, like international banking and nuclear weapons, to be made anti-fragile, meaning they are not only resilient to shocks, but strengthened by them. In principle, I agree. But a point often overlooked is that preparing for surprises, whether we are shooting for resilience or anti-fragility, is costly. We have to set priorities, which puts us back in the forecasting business. Consider building codes. In Tokyo, big new buildings have to be constructed with advanced engineering to withstand megaquakes. That's expensive. Does it make sense to incur that cost? The timing of earthquakes can't be predicted with precision, but seismologists know where they tend to occur and how big they are likely to be. Tokyo is earthquake central, so expensive engineering standards make sense. But in regions less prone to big quakes, particularly in poorer countries, the same standards make less sense. These sorts of probability estimates are at the heart of all long-term planning. But they are rarely as explicit as those in earthquake preparation. For decades, the United States had a policy of maintaining the capacity to fight two wars simultaneously. But why not three or four? Why not prepare for an alien invasion while we are at it? The answers hinge on probabilities. The two-war doctrine was based on a judgment that the likelihood of the military having to fight two wars simultaneously was high enough to justify the huge expense. But the same was not true of a three-war, four-war, or alien invasion future. Judgments like these are unavoidable, and if it sometimes looks like we've avoided them in long-term planning, that is only because we have swept them under the rug. That's worrisome. Probability judgments should be explicit, so we can consider whether they are as accurate as they can be. And if they are nothing but a guess, because that's the best we can do, we should say so. Knowing what we don't know is better than thinking we know what we don't. This comes into focus if we think about forecasting carefully, but we often don't, leading to absurdities like 20-year geopolitical forecasts and bestsellers about the coming century. I think both Taleb and Kahneman help explain why we keep making these sorts of mistakes. Kahneman and other pioneers of modern psychology have revealed that our minds crave certainty, and when they don't find it, they impose it. In forecasting, hindsight bias is the cardinal sin. Recall how experts, stunned by the Gorbachev surprise, quickly became convinced it was perfectly explicable, even predictable, although they hadn't predicted it. Brushing off surprises makes the past look more predictable than it was, and this encourages the belief that the future is more predictable than it is. Will China become the world's leading economic power in the mid-21st century? Many are sure it will, and it might. But in the 1980s and early 1990s, there was an even more prevalent belief that Japan would soon dominate the global economy, and its subsequent decline should at least give pause to those asserting China's ascendancy. But it often doesn't, because when looking back, it seems strange that anyone ever thought Japan would take the lead. Of course Japan would falter. It's obvious, in hindsight. Just as the prediction that China will not seems obvious today. Now consider what happens when this psychology encounters the reality Nassim Taleb described so well. In much of daily life, we encounter recurring events that fit the classic bell curve when graphed. For instance, most men are between 5 and 6 feet tall, far fewer are around 4 and 7 feet, and there are tiny numbers at 3 feet, the shortest man ever was just under 3 feet tall, and 8 feet, the tallest was just under 9 feet. But the bell curve doesn't fit everything, as the inequality of wealth in the United States demonstrates. Suppose that median household wealth is around $100,000, and 95% of households fall between $10,000 and $1 million. If wealth were distributed along a classic bell curve, like that on page 247, we would virtually never encounter a household with more than $10 million. And coming across a household with a net worth of $1 billion would be a 1 in trillions occurrence. But wealth isn't distributed normally. There are nearly 500 individuals with a net worth over $1 billion and a handful worth over $10 billion. The true distribution of wealth is a fat-tailed one that permits much more extreme outcomes. The true likelihood of someone in the United States being a billionaire rises sharply from 1 in trillions to roughly 1 in every 700,000. Now comes the hardest to grasp part of Taleb's view of the world. He posits that historical probabilities, all the possible ways the future could unfold, are distributed like wealth, not height. That means our world is vastly more volatile than most of us realize, and we're at risk of grave miscalculations. Let's time travel back to the summer of 1914. World War I is about to break out. Imagine a senior official in the British Foreign Office has assumed, incorrectly, that the death tolls from wars up to that point in history are normally distributed around an average of 100,000. His worst-case scenario is thus a war claiming about 1 million lives. Now he meets a forecaster who claims that Europe is about to plunge into a world war that will kill 10 million, followed by another world war that will kill 60 million. The policymaker sees this combination of catastrophes as vanishingly improbable, say 1 in several million. So he dismisses the forecaster as a crackpot. What would have happened if the policymaker had relied on a more realistic fat-tailed distribution of war casualties? He still would have seen the forecast as improbable, but it would now be thousands of times more probable than before. The impact would be analogous to your learning that your personal chances of winning the Powerball lottery on any ticket purchase have risen from 1 in 5 million to 1 in 500. Wouldn't you rush to buy tickets? A policymaker in 1914 who knew the true fat-tail risks of a mega-casualty war might well have tried a lot harder to avert the looming catastrophe. Or look at it this way. If height had a fat-tail distribution, it would still be very unusual to walk down the street and encounter a 12-foot man, followed by a 15-foot man, but such events could conceivably occur in one's lifetime. In the same light, now that we know that war casualties actually do have a fat-tail distribution, we should not be astonished when military historians tell us that World War II could have claimed more than 60 million lives if Hitler had launched the invasion of the Soviet Union earlier in 1941, or had intuited the destructive power of the atomic bomb. The possibilities were once real and numerous. Some find it hard wrapping their heads around Taleb's idea of statistical distributions of possible worlds. It feels like egg-headed nonsense. There is only one reality: what happened in the past, what we're living in now, and what will happen in the future. But if you are as mathematically inclined as Taleb, you get used to the idea that the world we live in is but one that emerged, quasi-randomly, from a vast population of once possible worlds. The past did not have to unfold as it did, the present did not have to be what it is, and the future is wide open. History is a virtually infinite array of possibilities. Prudent leaders feel this in their bones, as John F. Kennedy did when he realized the Cuban Missile Crisis had an array of possible outcomes, ranging from peace to nuclear annihilation, which could have pushed the death toll for World War III into the hundreds of millions. Fat tales indeed. Daniel Kahneman makes the point with a characteristically elegant thought experiment. He invites us to consider three leaders whose impact on the 20th century was massive: Hitler, Stalin, and Mao. Each came to power backed by a political movement that would never have accepted a female leader. But each man's origins can be traced to an unfertilized egg that had a 50% chance of being fertilized by different sperm cells and producing a female zygote that would become a female fetus